Time to look back on all of the stories that made headlines this week. We are talking about our reporter roundtable. Joining me live in studio to get us up to date are Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, and Kevin Richer with Idaho Ed News. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Thanks for having
us. Quickly, we have to say that Bill has a new title, Idaho Public Television. First time you're here at the roundtable in your new position.
That's right. I have a face for radio. I'm several weeks into the new gig, and it's exciting and challenging, and I'm very happy to be there.
Well, and we are happy to have you back on the program. We are less than 2 weeks away from the election, and we have been sitting here in the studio before we went on the air talking about everything that's going on. So let's start with some of these commercials that we're seeing on the air. Betsy, there's been some controversy. Some have been pulled. Some of them are back or in a different form.
There are lots of ads, and really the most hot and heavy back and forth has been on Proposition 1, the horse racetrack betting machine initiative. There have been multiple ads put out by both sides, and they have gotten so bitter that we now have ads out this week from both sides calling the other side liars, and in some cases with some validity. it's a really emotional issue for the people who are very deeply involved in it, less so for people who know nothing about it and are kind of confused by what the whole thing is doing on our ballot in the first place.
Well, and I think that's part of it, right? I mean, we have talked about the Save Idaho Horse Racing Initiative from both sides on this program, and I tell you what, it is still confusing, I think, for the general public. What do these ads do then? Because I've seen them, and I think it confuses the issue even more.
Basically,
almost.
I don't think that the ads are aimed at alleviating the confusion. Really, the issue is not that confusing. There were these machines that were legal from 2013, 2015. They are no longer legal, and the measure would make them legal again. And they're similar to slot machines. But the aim of the ads basically is to tear down the other side and say the people who are pushing it are bad. No, the people who are opposing it are bad.
What's fascinating about this particular issue and this particular campaign is this is a proxy for all these other issues and values in Idaho. You know, the way people feel about tribal casinos and the way people feel about wealthy racetrack owners. So there's all these other factors that go into what is, like Betsy said, a really simple decision about whether these machines ought to be legal or not. And so what you're seeing, and I think that's one reason why it's so confusing, is because there's all this other stuff going on, mm-hmm. all these other proxy issues out there that is really confusing.
And because both sides have so much money to put into this campaign. That's the jaw-dropping thing to me, is how much money on both sides you're seeing poured into this race. And money's got to go somewhere, and it's obviously going into a flood of advertisements.
And that's because gambling is very big business. And one complicating factor in all this is something that's practically a footnote in the initiative, that there's a loophole in existing Idaho law that the Greyhound Park up in Post Falls can have betting on simulcasts of horse and dog races ever since 1996, when Idaho banned dog racing out of concern over abuse of dogs at that track. Now, that facility has been written into this initiative so that when we try to save Idaho horse racing by bringing these lucrative machines to Idaho racetracks,
dot, dot, and dogs,
we also put them at that track. And there are no limits on how many they do. They're not part of this new charitable foundation that would donate proceeds. It's really raising a lot of different questions aside from this central premise that the sponsors of the initiative want to focus on, which is if you could get these machines back at Les Bois Park, they'd make more money and be able to have more horse races.
So the irony is the biggest beneficiary could be a defunct dog track in North Idaho, the owner of which lives in, is it Alabama?
Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Yeah.
Oh, well, so there you go. Fascinating.
The other thing that strikes me about this false campaign is you have Proposition 1, Proposition 2. Proposition 2 really is about whether we're going to extend health care to this group of people. It's a pretty simple question. I think people understand the bounds. But Proposition 1, it's just the opposite. There's all this other stuff going on, and it's really not about the very premise of, mm-hmm. of the measure.
I would agree with that, absolutely. Okay, so then, Kevin, now we have some other ads running, and this has to do with the race for public instruction.
Right. So we've seen some advertisements this week paid for by the Idaho Education Association, and they're targeting Sherry Ibarra. These are, you know, ads pointing out several points in Navarro's record, the $100 million error in their original budget recommendation, the snafu over the school security plan. The back and forth over graduation rates and her claims that graduation rates have improved. It's an interesting ad in the sense that it does not mention Cindy Wilson, who is Ibarra's opponent, who the IEA has endorsed. The ad mentions Idaho Education News. It mentions Betsy Russell's reporting. We're not running for state superintendent either of us. So it doesn't mention Cindy Wilson.
Doesn't mention Bill.
Well, you know, we know he's not running for state superintendent. And what's interesting about the ad is that it ends with this call Sherry Ibarra's office at the State Department of Education and say that she's not fit to be state superintendent. It's a strange
ad. Wouldn't you
ad.
Say go to the polls and vote?
It says nothing about vote. It says nothing about Cindy Wilson. It's a weird ad.
The interesting thing about this ad, and I actually have a story in the works on this, is that it's set up like the old issue ads prior to Citizens United, when outside groups were forbidden from expressly advocating for or against a candidate. But that's not true anymore. They could have, if they wanted to, said vote for Cindy Wilson, not for Sherry Ibarra. But they chose instead to follow this kind of old model where we say, this person's bad, call them to tell them you think so without ever saying vote or don't vote. It's not really clear why they chose that.
As Kevin was talking, I was wondering if the IEA is planning to do something similar in the governor's race. They have endorsed in that race, too. Do you know, are they planning any kind of ad buys in the governor's race?
I don't know that.
Okay.
Okay. So then, Bill, talk to us about what's going on with Lieutenant Governor candidate Janet McGeehan and this whole kind of posse.
Well, now that I've gone from print to public television, and I kind of watch in here on the outskirts of the effort to put these debates together, and there are a lot of work and a lot of time and effort goes into them. But there's all this other stuff that seems to be happening around the debate. So what people actually see on the screen during the 30 or 60 minutes isn't always reflected in the reality. In this case, what happened is McGeehan, who was running for lieutenant governor against Christy McCollum, showed up at Idaho Public Television with a group of people who were providing security for her. And it's not clear who they are. It's not clear exactly why. There's not a lot of details about it. But I heard somebody describe it as kind of her traveling with a posse. And they showed up and they took positions to kind of protect the entrances to the building. And so it was a very odd experience. There wasn't anything particularly untoward or unpleasant. It was just kind of this odd moment in what has become this kind of odd campaign in Idaho. We don't usually have candidates traveling with security or bodyguards.
Right.
Even the governor shows up with very little security.
Not to mention four of them.
Exactly.
So one at each door.
there were nobody behaved badly. I think there was some awkwardness, but I think it's just maybe it's a symbol, like some of these ads we're seeing, that campaigns in Idaho are catching up to the rest of the country in fears and worries and in some cases bitterness.
Mm-hmm. And then what's interesting on top of this is then, you know, we just saw that report come out about voter turnout and what the expectation is going to be. And for midterms especially, I mean, this could be a record-breaking turnout.
I found it really surprising that Ada County is forecasting 73% turnout in a non-presidential year. That is huge.
It's huge.
I wish that our current Secretary of State, Lawrence Denny, were making forecasts like his predecessor, Ben Azurza, did, because it'd be nice to hear what the forecast is statewide.
That would be interesting, too,
yeah.
Because this was in particular about Ada County, but statewide. So speaking of debates, Betsy, you were at the second congressional district debate last night.
That's right. The second district candidates had their second debate. This is Congressman Mike Simpson and his Democratic challenger, Aaron Swisher. This was on KTVB. Earlier, they debated on the Idaho debates on Idaho Public Television. And from my perch as a member of the reporter panel last night, the thing that I was struck by was how civil it was. These two candidates both staked out some very moderate positions, and while they disagreed with and criticized each other mildly, they also found some common ground and had a really spirited debate. I was surprised when the moderator asked Congressman Simpson if he had read Aaron Swisher's book. So Aaron Swisher is an economist who's mm-hmm. written a book called Resuscitating America that lays out his plan for how he thinks all sides are wrong and this is what we need to do to improve our economy. And Congressman Simpson said yes. And he said it wasn't crazy. There are some things
that wasn't crazy
that are worth, that are, worth my considering. And actually, it looks like a fair number of people read Aaron Swisher's book. I noticed when I looked it up on Amazon, the first comment that I saw was from retired Idaho Ninth Circuit Judge Stephen Trott, saying some interesting things about the book and some of its ideas. So I think that it was a debate focused on policy, which was kind of a nice thing to see, not on personality.
Kind of a nice change, right, to actually get to the issues versus, yeah, the personalities differences. So, Kevin, you just wrote an article today that came out in Idaho Ed News about SAT scores.
Yeah.
And not great.
Right. So what we found out about the latest round of the SAT scores is that the scores dropped a little bit in Idaho, not very much. The drop isn't terribly significant. But what we did, we tried to compare Idaho's SAT scores with other states where the SAT is the college entrance exam of choice, where kids can take the test during the school day for free because it's covered by taxpayers. And what we found is that Idaho's scores do not compare favorably with most other states that have that kind of high participation. We're a little bit ahead of Delaware and the District of Columbia. The reason this is all significant, too, is that there's been talk about test scores in these elections where Brad Little and Sherry Ibarra have both talked about improvements or high performance on the ACT, which is kind mm-hmm. of a competing college entrance exam. But here, relatively few Idaho students are taking the ACT and probably doing it in order to get into a more selective college or to compete for scholarship money. So it stands to reason that their performance would be better on that test.
We are continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My guest today, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News, and Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television. Betsy, the Campaign Finance Reform Interim Committee had a meeting, I believe, late last week, and get us updated on what some of their recommendations are. We did have Representative Erpelding on earlier this week to talk about it. He's part of that. But for people that have missed that, if we could get
this
updated.
This time of year, my sense of time is very skewed, but I think it was on Monday.
Oh, was it? Okay, that's what I was like. I couldn't remember if it was Friday or Monday,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So this was the last of a long series of very intensive meetings that this Joint Interim Committee has had over the summer to try to figure out what to propose as far as a pretty sweeping slate of campaign finance reforms to the legislature. And a big bill was proposed last year, unanimously endorsed by an interim committee, and it didn't go anywhere in the legislature. And so they came back this year with an eye to, well, should they break it up into pieces? Should they reconsider some of the parts? They really focused just on the things that pretty much all of them agreed on.
Mm-hmm.
But it still came out with some pretty substantial changes that they will be presenting to the full legislature in January. And the whole committee agreed that they all ought to show up at the hearings and that maybe that would help. I mean, these are senators and representatives from both parties. And it's things like more frequent campaign finance reporting so mm-hmm. that you wouldn't have to wait until 7 days before the primary election before you find out anything about who's behind any of the campaigns. And so that you wouldn't have to go all summer long until October 10th before you find out what or who has been doing anything since the primary.
Right.
And so what they are looking at is monthly reporting for the 4 months prior to the election. There are also quite a number of other changes, including extending disclosure requirements all the way down to all levels of government in Idaho whenever anyone has raised or spent at least $500. There was unanimous agreement on this. And it would all go into a central searchable database operated by the Idaho Secretary of State's office, so we wouldn't be dealing with these 250-page PDFs anymore.
Right.
Try to see who gave what to what campaign.
And then they also talked about what is it with the deadline and being what a $50 charge per
yes,
day?
Yes, there was also unanimous agreement that the current system where candidates who don't file their campaign finance disclosure reports on time essentially get a 5-day waiting period before the $50 a day fines kicked in. They ought to do away with that, they decided, and have the fines start on day one.
But also it comes down to discretion with that, correct?
Well, because currently there is some discretion.
Right.
And under this change, there would be no discretion. And actually, Secretary of State Lawrence Denny said he didn't want discretion. He said, you guys just
deal with it.
Tell me what to do and I'll do it.
And when Representative Erpelding was on the program, he said Monday that he knew of some candidates that had still yet to file that.
I'm actually tracking that right now. There are a number that are facing fines.
So we will.
And actually, I should say there are very few candidates who are facing fines, but there are a number of PACs. Mm. There is at least one candidate who's already paid a $50 fine.
Is it your sense that,
candidate?
Is that disorganization? Is that laziness? Or is it a deliberate attempt to just obscure the paper trail?
I think it really varies. I think it varies case by case. I think that there are, for example, in the primary, there was a Democratic legislative candidate from North Idaho who was fined $400, and she had never filed. And when the Secretary of State's office contacted her, she wouldn't get back to them. She didn't think she needed to file because she had not raised any money. They went back and forth and back and forth, and they turned it over to the Attorney General's office. And that was, basically a case of misunderstanding, I think, but also resistance to what the law required. Mm.
And, Kevin, let's talk about this 60% goal again. Some new information came out this week, and basically we are just nowhere near that goal.
Not only are we nowhere near the goal, we're not even moving closer to it. So the latest numbers that we got for 2016 and 2017 reveal that 42% of Idaho's 25 to 34-year-olds have either a college degree or some sort of professional certificate. That number hasn't changed since 2015. It's been stagnant for 3 years. And the state's goal is to get to 60%. This has been a goal that the state has been behind since 2010.
But we've moved it.
And we've moved the target date back from 2020 to 2025. And really, my takeaway on this is that a lot of what the state is trying to do to move those numbers, we're talking about very long-term initiatives. We're talking about trying to encourage high school students to think more thoughtfully and more deliberately about their futures and, allow them to get college credits while they're in high school and have more scholarship money available for them. We're talking about high school students. We're talking about years down the road, these high school students, maybe 25 to 34-year-olds who have a college degree or a certificate. So it's really a long-term initiative. That kind of came out in sort of the reactions to the numbers. And I get that this is a long-term initiative and that we're trying to change attitudes for students who are in high school and even in the earlier grades, but the numbers haven't moved and really haven't moved very much over the course of the decade. So this is a long slog for the state, and that was what really jumped out at me when these numbers came out.
Bill?
This has been an ongoing story almost since they first named this as a goal, and we've written about it a number of times, and I've often asked and never really gotten a good answer. Is it the wrong goal? Mm. Right? Do we have the wrong people in charge? Because if we're not moving the needle and we're spending a lot of money, and Kevin tallied up the cost, and it's not insignificant, it's $133 million
that we've put into these various initiatives.
And we're not moving the needle.
We're looking at a needle that it's almost on a different plane in terms of a different age group than what we're targeting with these initiatives. I mean, you could definitely ask the question at this point, is it the right goal or not, and is it the right time frame or not? I mean, we didn't dream up the idea at Idaho Education News that, we could hit the 60% goal in 2020 or 2025. Those are some of the most thoughtful people in education, business, and politics who are pushing this goal. 2025 is only 7 years away.
Right.
It's going to be quite a lift for the state to try to get to a 60% threshold. A lot of states are struggling with this. That's an important thing to keep in mind. But, 18 percentage points, thousands upon thousands of young adults with a degree or certificate in a short amount of time. I mean, it's a very narrow window.
And Kevin, I was going to say, there aren't any states that have met this 60% goal, correct? I mean, close, but...
I mean, no. I mean, if you look at... If you look at all adults, which is kind of the way I've seen it done, no state is at that 60% goal when you think about all adults. So it's and most states have similar goals to Idaho's. I mean, the numbers may vary, the metrics may vary. You may be looking at young adults or all adults. Regardless, almost every state is trying to do this because they feel like they need to have workers who are better prepared for the jobs of today and the jobs of tomorrow, and that their states are more competitive to land those kind of jobs and those kind of employers. Almost every state is trying to push for this. Almost every state is struggling at one level or another. We just got, kind of a, cold water in the face about where Idaho's struggle is and where Idaho's where Idaho stands 7 years into this campaign.
And I want to switch. We've got about a minute and a half left, and about a complete switch. The scooters, they're everywhere. We have talked about this week. We had the city of Boise on, the city of Meridian on, and love them or hate them, they're everywhere, Bill.
It's funny because there were none, and then there were a bunch everywhere. And a couple weeks, it's been a couple weeks now, when Meridian tried that experiment, my daughter got one, and we were driving it up and down our street, and they are super fun. They're super cool. But they are dangerous. Those little tiny wheels, it's really easy to hit a rock or get cocky and crash. And I think if we're going to have them, and I think we should, I think we need to be thinking about how we make helmets available and how we give people a chance to make sure they're riding them safely. Because I think we're going to see some injuries.
That's what I'm concerned about. I saw two kids riding them together just yesterday downtown Boise. I'm honestly,
which of course is against the rules.
It's against the rules. Well, and you're supposed to be 18 years or older. And when the city of Boise was on, I asked them that question: How do you are you going to be enforcing this? And you know, and the answer was, well, you know, you have to put your identification in, and I was like, well. I've known teenagers that have had fake IDs. But also, if mom and dad swipe it, I mean, you've got that issue. So I agree with you. It is going to be so interesting to see how this moves forward. The city of Boise will be relooking at the ordinances in January.
Right.
To see if they have to switch, fix anything.
And they could very well end up allowing more scooters than the 750 we have right now. And I think we all know that duct taping a lawn chair to the scooter will remain against the law.
There we go. That is the final word. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I want to thank my guests today, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News, and Bill Manning with Idaho Public Television. Bill, we're going to see that happen now.